Betrayed by Good Intentions by Barbara Pierce. Barbara Pierce lives in Oberlin, Ohio. She is editor of the largest circulation monthly magazine in the blindness field, the National Federation of the Blind's Braille Monitor. This fact is particularly relevant to her story, which details the harmful actions of a well-meaning but misguided high school English teacher. Fortunately, the actions of another teacher, along with Barbara's own developing confidence, did much to undo the damage. Here's what she has to say. For most of my working life, I have manipulated words. I have both read and written them, and through the years I have learned to make them do what I want them to. But it was not always so. Oh, I made A's in English in high school, but I hated to write, and reading was something of a strain since I could not see the print, much less read it. Sometimes I could find recordings of the novels we were assigned, and sometimes the literature texts had been recorded by Recording for the Blind, the not-for-profit organization that even today records books for students, scholars, and professionals. But even though I disliked writing, I'd always loved English, and I wanted to qualify to take advanced placement English my senior year. To do so, we had to take a test during the spring of my junior year. I was told that arrangements would be made for me to take the test orally. So I reported to the testing room, expecting to be pulled out to take the test with a reader, probably one of the teachers. I was told to report to the cafeteria, where the teacher whom I most trusted, and who, up to that point, had showed the most confidence in my ability, was waiting for me. I was completely unprepared for what happened next. He began lecturing me in the nicest possible way about my unfitness for taking on the challenge of AP English. Of course, that was not how he put it. He pointed out that I had nothing more to prove to demonstrate my academic ability. I was an A student, and the AP course would tax my resources. It would certainly demand more than my parents could be expected to read for me. That line of argument put me at a severe disadvantage. I had not been taught Braille, and no one had yet proposed the concept that a blind student should have accessible versions of all textbooks. In each course, I was handed the print book and expected to figure out how to get my work done. Having two of the best parents ever created, I did not find this an impossibility, but I recognized that there were limits to what I could ask my folks to do to help me. On the other hand, how would I know whether I could do demanding work unless I tried doing it? I could feel myself sliding into despair. I was about to apply to colleges. If I could not manage to do demanding high school work, how could I expect to do college-level work? I began to cry, but the teacher only redoubled his preaching. I could get into college on the basis of regular college prep coursework. Why destroy my senior year by taking on more work than I could possibly do? Didn't I want to have some time for fun, maybe dating during my final year in high school? Doing the AP work would be harder for me than for any of the other students. And where would I be at graduation time if I could not finish the course and came up a credit short? At 16, I had never heard of the National Federation of the Blind. I did not recognize that I was facing what President Bush has called the soft bigotry of lowered expectations. So I capitulated. I told my beloved teacher that I would not insist on taking the test. I would settle for the standard college prep course. I was allowed to arrange my schedule with a study hall during the AP class period, so that I could sit in on class discussions several times a week. But it was not the same. I recognized that those students were getting better exposure to college-level work than I was, and I felt betrayed and diminished by the realization. For some reason, this discouragement did not prevent me from setting my sights high with my college applications. I was admitted to Oberlin College by early decision, and I awaited the fall semester with more than a little trepidation. After all, I had not even been able to test myself doing one college-level course. How would I manage when I was faced with five at the same time and without my parents' assistance to do the reading? That first semester of my first year of college was a bit rocky, the experience most college students have. I knew that I would have to hire lots of student readers, and I did so. I did not enjoy freshman composition, a requirement for all incoming students. I discovered that I disliked writing even more, and my confidence in doing English in general had been badly shaken by my high school experience. So, English was a continuing struggle. One of the most challenging courses in a constructive way, and the one that in profound ways changed my life was introductory biology. This was a very large lecture course taught by the entire biology department. We were then divided into laboratory sections for 1 3-hour session a week. As far as I know, by the luck of the draw, I was assigned to a Friday afternoon lab section that was taught by a young botanist who walked with a decided limp. I did not know at the time that she had used a wheelchair until she was in college. Then surgery restored her ability to walk, and therefore to do field work. She had enough first-hand experience of disability to have very healthy attitudes about my potential ability to do biology. She and I became friends. We went on hikes in which she introduced me to plants, the identification of birds by their songs, and the shapes of leaves. She was as determined as I that I would do all the lab work. I was assigned a lab partner, and the two of us and the pair across the lab table got on with our work. My job became to know what we were supposed to be seeing under the microscope. Theirs was to report what they actually saw. Among us, we cobbled together our observations. The other three were somewhat sobered when I began getting A's to their B's, but that made me an increasingly valuable part of the team. In the meantime, the professor had decided that it would not do for me to miss out on the dissection of the crawfish and the fetal pig, though she recognized that I would have some difficulties in doing exactly what the other students were expected to do. She acquired a lobster, which she assured me was assembled in the same way as the crawfish, but on a larger scale. She insisted that I wear surgical gloves for dissection, since she was afraid that the formaldehyde would damage my sense of touch and make reading Braille more difficult. She worked with me one-on-one to do the fetal pig dissections, and gradually I mastered the lessons she taught me. When it came time for tests, she insisted on being my tester. She wanted to make certain that the descriptions of the various lab station test questions contained no leading information that might give me hints about the correct answer. She would begin a description by saying, "Under the microscope I see several blobs with clusters of smaller blobs inside them." I would try to ask questions that would not solicit information that I did not deserve, but that would strengthen or destroy my hypothesis about what was being asked. The only way to prepare for such testing is to know the material cold. When my high scores on the lab tests raised some skepticism within the biology faculty, another professor quietly slipped into the lab to observe the testing procedure. It was pronounced free of bias, and the A's I received both semesters were declared appropriate. Moreover, the faculty told me that they would be pleased to have me consider majoring in biology. I actually left Oberlin that spring with the intention of doing exactly that. My confidence in my abilities to do English had been badly shaken by my high school mentor, and even though I had done good work in my literature course second semester, my mediocre composition grade had confirmed all the questions my high school teachers had raised in my heart. My determination to major in biology continued until the fall of my sophomore year. It led me to sign up for chemistry, which was required of biology majors. I had already fulfilled the college requirement of 8 hours of science. But even when I decided that I really did not want to teach high school biology, so why on earth was I majoring in it, I decided to keep the chemistry class, in which I earned A's both semesters. If I had been a member of the National Federation of the Blind, I might well have known biology majors who were doing things other than teaching high school biology. Left to my own inexperience, I did not have much confidence in my ability to pursue graduate work toward a career other than teaching, but I could imagine myself successfully doing a major in the field. That was solely thanks to one professor who believed that nobody had the right to tell me that I could not succeed in her field. In fact, her notion was that a teacher's job was to figure out ways to support the hopes and dreams of her students, and that is what she did. I do not know how much damage my well-meaning high school teachers might have done to me if it had not been for my biology professor. It was to be many years before I would meet and be influenced by blind people in the National Federation of the Blind who would teach me the same lesson. But she was there when I needed her, and my response to her gift of confidence in me has been to pass it along whenever I could. Blindness does not necessarily mean the end of any dream. Gradually, I discovered that even an English major at one of the most demanding colleges in the country was not beyond me, despite what my high school teachers had thought. Maybe they just did not want to bother helping me figure out how to do what I would have needed to do to complete that AP English course. I will never know, but they almost stifled a young woman with promise. I rejoice that today the NFB is present to protect students from such well-meaning mistakes.